Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. You also get access to ad-free versions of the podcast. We recently released a bonus episode on Ted Lasso, and we have another bonus episode in the works on Kathryn Bigelow's Strange Days and other films lost in the transition to streaming. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps
and Tasha Robinson.
Genevieve is off blissfully touring her best memories, but she'll return to our podcast dystopia soon. But as a special treat to my co-host, Keith and Tasha, who did make it out to Sweet Emulsion Studios for this recording, I'm offering you the incredible opportunity to either relive or erase the movie memory of your choice. I'm like the Sylvester McMonkey McBean of the memory game, and you're like the Sneetches going through my memory on and memory off machines.
Wow, that is a really tortured way of putting that.
Well, that's the words of someone who doesn't want to go to our Frankfurter roasts, or picnics, or parties, or marshmallow toasts. What about you, Keith? I've come to help you. I have what you need, and my prices are low, and I work at great speed.
Apparently I'm reliving the memory of having Dr. Seuss read to me as a child. Anyway, yes, I'm in. You never get a chance to see your favorite movie again for the first time, so I'd like to see The Umbrellas of Cherbourg for the first time.
Great. Done. Step into the memory on machine. Well, how'd it go, Keith?
Incredible movie, but I have to say the venue could have been better. The floors were sticky, the seats were broken, and a couple sat behind me and talked the entire time, even though no one else was in the theater.
Did I not mention that occasionally the memories are cursed? I'm still working out the kinks of the machine.
Okay, I want to try the memory off machine. I would like to unwatch Avatar The Last Airbender, the M. Night Shyamalan movie. I really just don't need any of those memories.
Whew. Good choice. I believe you and I saw that in fake 3D too, didn't we, Tasha?
I'm afraid so.
I'm sure everyone would want to forget that movie exists. Hey, Tasha, welcome back. You know, M. Night Shyamalan really needed a bounce back after The Happening was such a flop.
Yeah, it's crazy that it took him 5 years to make After Earth. He's usually more prolific than that, but I guess he really needed a long break. Feels like something's missing, though.
A live-action version of an animated Nickelodeon cartoon adventure series, perhaps?
No, that sounds terrible. No, something is missing from this burrito. It has no crunch at all. There's no texture to it. You can bite right through it. What a nightmare.
Well, I'm going to pack up my suitcase full of money and leave town. In the meantime, can someone talk about this week's pairing?
Sure. With her directorial debut, Reminiscence, Lisa Joy attempts the kind of ambitious, idea-driven science fiction she and co-creator Jonathan Nolan had done for 3 seasons on the HBO series Westworld. And like Westworld, Reminiscence takes place in a dystopic future where technology has allowed the most privileged among us to enter into a world of high-tech fantasy. Hugh Jackman stars as the head of a business that offers clients the chance to relive the memory of their choice, but when one of those clients, played by Rebecca Ferguson, comes in hoping to find a misplaced set of keys, it opens up a much more complicated mystery. That uneasy interaction between memories and reality calls to mind a similar business in writer Charlie Kaufman and director Michel Gondry's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet stars exes who use the service to erase one another from their memories after their breakup.
So this week, we'll once again enter the anxious metaphysical world of Charlie Kaufman with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And next week, we'll step into another magical memory machine with Lisa Joy's Reminiscence. Please join us.
Hello, I'm Howard Mirziak, founder and president of Lacuna Incorporated. Why remember a destructive love affair? Here at Lacuna, we have perfected a safe, effective technique for the focused erasure of troubling memories. In a matter of hours, our patented non-surgical procedure will rid you of painful memories and allow you a new and lasting peace of mind you'd never imagined possible.
Though Charlie Kaufman would eventually go on to direct films like Synecdoche, New York, Anomalisa, and last year's I'm Thinking of Ending Things, he had the distinction, for a decade at least, of being the only screenwriter who tended to get credited over the director. The proof was in the auteurist pudding. Being John Malkovich, Human Nature, and Adaptation all shared a common genius for high concept and high-minded conceits that probe the thornier aspects of human experience, our neediness, our desires, and how our best and worst instincts are often at war with each other. Coffin would inevitably put some version of himself in the narrative too, usually an anxious, scruffy guy with a thin layer of flop sweat attached to his face. He would not make loving his characters an easy task, but at least we could appreciate the full splendor of their neuroses. With Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Kaufman finally teamed up with a director in Michel Gondry who could complement the full force of his vision with some equal tricks of his own. The two had worked together before on the uneven comedy Human Nature, but here Kaufman's ideas unlocked the visual magicianship that had made Gondry one of the great video directors ever. The one who utilized stop motion or old camera tricks to work wonders for the likes of Bjork, Kylie Minogue, and the White Stripes. It wasn't going to be enough for Gondry to be deferential to Kaufman's writing, like Spike Jonze had been in his unvarnished work for Being John Malkovich in Adaptation. Gondry needed to visualize the extremely abstract idea of a man dashing around the corners of his own mind, trying to outrun memories that were erasing and collapsing around him. Let's back up for a second. Eternal Sunshine starts with Joel Barish, a very unimpulsive guy played by Jim Carrey, who takes an impulsive trip to the beaches of Montauk in the middle of winter. Along the way, he meets the genuinely impulsive Clementine, played by Kate Winslet, who has blue-dyed hair and has taken an active interest in him, which, in the classic Kaufman style, unnerves him as much as it excites him. When Clementine asks if she can nap at his place, Joel agrees, but she has to stop back home for a toothbrush. While she's gone, a baffled young man knocks on the window. "Can I help you?" he wonders incredulously. Who is this guy who seems to know him? And why does he seem so freaked out? Cut to the opening credits. The answers will come later when we discover that Joel and Clementine have actually broken up. And not only have they broken up, but Joel has learned that a company called Lacuna fulfilled Clementine's request to have all memories of Joel erased from her head. Already reeling from their breakup, Joel storms into Lacuna's office and winds up paying for the same procedure. He's told to throw everything that reminded him of Clementine into garbage bags. Photos, gifts, clothing, and pages from the scrapbook diary he'd been updating since that first day in Montauk. And then he records a tape detailing all his feelings about the relationship. These are the breadcrumbs that Lacuna needs to ease his suffering. "Won't I get brain damage?" Joel wonders. Technically, the procedure is brain damage, he's told. For a piece of science fiction, the procedure itself is delightfully analog, with an old computer and wires, and what looks like a metal pasta strainer attached to Joel's head while he sleeps. It's Kaufman and Gondry's way of focusing the audience's attention on the characters instead. What Joel discovers in his weird state of half-sleep, where he can hear the whisperings of the technicians around him, including one, played by Elijah Wood, who is using his information to pursue Clementine himself, is that he doesn't want these memories erased. He's made a very big mistake, and he rebels by hiding his consciousness from view and taking Clementine with him. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind makes an unexpected but very moving argument for the preciousness of memories, even memories that are painful and whole relationships that seem regrettable. We are, after all, the sum product of our experiences, and not all of those experiences are going to be happy ones. Or maybe those experiences start to change shape and meaning over time, and seem constructive when they might have once been excruciating. Joel and Clementine come out of the Lacuna experience with the impulse to start again, knowing that they likely won't succeed a second time either. They know that the flaws that they found in each other still exist, and they know that the differences they have may be irreconcilable, but the memories they make together will be important no matter what. We'll talk about it after the break.
It's all falling apart. I'm erasing you and I'm happy. You did it to me first.
I can't believe you did this to me.
Clem, can you hear me? By morning, you'll be gone! The perfect ending to this piece of shit story!
All right, so what is your history with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and how does it look in the year 2021? I seem to recall the three of us being pretty over the moon for it at the time, but maybe I'm wrong on that. What do you all think?
We were over the moon for it at the time and collectively named it the best film of the aughts at the end of that decade, in our AV Club poll. And I think it was not a movie that anybody wasn't on board with giving that honor, or at least ranking pretty high on their list. And for me, it still really holds up. What about you, Tasha?
I don't think it holds up as well as I went back and listened to the commentary track with Gondry and Kaufman, and they openly talk about how this is a movie that they mean for people to watch several times, mm-hmm. Because it plays so differently the second, third, fourth time you watch it when you understand the tricks and you've unraveled the narrative. That first experience, I mean, it's like the first experience of watching, oh, I don't know, to pick a random movie out of a hat, being John Malkovich or Schenectady, New York. You know, that feeling of, I have no idea what's going to happen here is often a pretty precious one to a film critic, because we see so many movies, we see the same tropes and the same ideas play out so many times. And, you know, this is just such an incredibly original vision with such an incredibly unpredictable and original construction. I think it's probably still a fabulous movie, but watching it this time, I think, you know, for the maybe fourth time or so, I found a lot of tripping points with it. And it mostly comes down to how much I dislike Joel and Clementine, both individually and as characters. So I didn't love it the way I loved it the first time through. I don't think that that's a knock on the film. I think that the film's construction and execution is just so blisteringly creative and ambitious and wild. But in spite of what the director and writer think, I'm not sure that it's a movie that is best the third or fourth time you see it.
That is surprising. I, of course, loved it the first time, and I was afraid to say I loved it this time as well. But like, I think that note about it being, you know, something that's worth watching more than once is certainly true. I was very much thrown for a loop by it the first time I saw it, and needed a second viewing at the time to really get a feeling for what was going on and really actually be moved by, you know, the kind of driving sentiment of it. I always like it when a movie like that can make a complicated philosophical argument. That, I guess that is the Charlie Kaufman touch. I mean, you see it mimicked in something like Inside Out, which is kind of like a Pixar movie that through its complicated conceit is, you know, makes an argument in favor of sadness and the importance of sadness. That's a hard thing to do in a kid's film. So I kind of appreciate all the loops that it kind of goes through to make what is a fairly profound and moving point. What got to me this viewing, though, were the side characters. You know, all of the drama going on, the love triangle, I suppose, between Elijah Wood and Mark Ruffalo and Kirsten Dunst's characters. I thought that's just a whole nother drama to unpack that was just fascinating to me, you know, just to see all of these, like, and did I mention Tom Wilkinson?
You said Elijah Wood.
No, so I'm wrong. Not Elijah Wood's off. That's fascinating in its own right. Him kind of stealing from Joel to try to stealing Joel's moves and not to lesser effect to try to win over Clementine. But no, I guess I'm talking about the love triangle between Tom Wilkinson and Mark Ruffalo and Kirsten Dunst, which was full of surprises. And again, it was just, you know, it's this idea of what harm can come of the fantasy of not having to go through a painful experience, of just being able to just take something that is regrettable, that is ended in disappointment and humiliation, and just dispose of it. For the film to kind of get into what's lost in doing that, you know, and the side characters is, you know, in addition to Joel and Clementine, I thought was really great.
It's the emotional equivalent of you know, not touching a hot stove twice. Except if you remove that information, Kirsten Dunst's character, Marriott, is going to keep touching that hot stove over and over again and getting hurt each time. Yeah, I'd forgotten how involved and distinct and, you know, moving in their own way that those stories were as well. Because I remember it was definitely being the Kate Winslet, Jim Carrey story, and it's still certainly the focus, but all that stuff happening in on the side is really quite fascinating, and I think also plays into the central themes of it. It's a neat mirroring there. I also like, they only have a couple of scenes, but I like David Cross and Jane Addams as a functional yet terrible couple, you know, example of how these long-term relationships can last and still and but also be a huge drag, you know. A lot of things are very well thought through here.
One point that I made in the keynote here was that this is like one instance where there was a real balance or harmony between two very strong visions here, Charlie Kaufman and Michel Gondry. And I was curious to get your thoughts about how, what kind of identifies the film as a product of each of them and how those styles mesh.
You know, I'm not sure that this has ever fully come into focus for me before, but seeing I'm Thinking of Ending Things in this movie so close in proximity to each other, I feel like, you know, a Charlie Kaufman movie because it's fundamentally about a sad man who hates it inside his own head. And he literalizes that over and over. Like in Anomalisa, the protagonist sees everybody in the world as looking identical and nobody stands out because that's how he processes other people. And he hates it and he's miserable. In Adaptation, you've got somebody who's stuck writing a piece that he doesn't know how to write and he doesn't know how to escape and he's miserable. In Schenectady, you have somebody who is creating a piece of art that he is haunting him and obsessing him and he's miserable. Miserable. And like here and in I'm Thinking of Ending Things, you have somebody who's miserable and is literally trapped inside his own head, like literally, physically, tangibly stuck with all of these things that are happening that he's either fantasizing about or reliving and trying not to lose. And I think listening to the commentary track too, I definitely got the impression of him as just like a very depressed and anxious, incredibly smart man who is well aware of kind of his personal neuroses and anxieties. Just this sort of feeling of, I can't, no matter where I go, I can't escape myself. And I think that this movie is, you know, up there with I'm Thinking of Ending Things in terms of literalizing that idea. But I think that's just fundamentally his thing, is that feeling of being trapped in a world that you hate because that world is you.
So for me, that run between being John Malkovich and this film, when he is working with directors, is kind of the Charlie Kaufman sweet spot. You know, I'll watch every Charlie Kaufman movie he directs at the first possibility, but I do think after this, and maybe it may just be this detail that sets it apart, but the scripts kind of lose their ability to find even a shred of hopefulness. And you know, watch the Adaptation and this, and being John Malkovich, perhaps, maybe that one the least of those three. There's at least like an idea that you can get to the other side of this sort of solipsism that his you know, returning, you know, his most strongly recurring theme. Will these kids make it after the end of the movie? It's an unanswered question, but it's not necessarily no. I mean, I don't think they closed off that possibility. You know, after that, I feel like there is much less of that. In fact, it may just disappear entirely. I think, especially like Jones's films, I do think this is the best of them. I think Gondry is not just counterbalancing. I like Jones's kind of the flatness he brings to those films. I think it's really kind of a good way to frame those really wild concepts. I think Gondry is giving a little something extra here. He's getting a lot of Gondry-ness to it, and I think it really works here.
I can't believe I left out being John Malkovich in my run of talking about Kaufman films, because I mean that's another movie about literally somebody who hates it so much inside his own head that he escapes into somebody else's head, and then that becomes like the driving fantasy, and then in the end the hell on earth for him is, you know, being stuck in a head that he can't escape.
I think I would want to make kind of two points at once here, just to address what you just said. I think the difference with Eternal Sunshine is that Joel, at a certain point, fights for his own headspace, right? I mean, like, he doesn't want...
And fights to make a connection with another human being,
yeah,
too.
I mean, like there is a point where, you know, I mean, he is maybe the type of personality, maybe the Kaufman-esque personality who wants to crumple this stuff up and throw it in the trash, right? He doesn't want to be in his head. He certainly doesn't want a bad relationship to cloud his headspace, but then there is a mad scramble to hold on to those things, and there's something quite romantic in that idea. The other thing I would say too is, like, think about the impact that Kaufman has on Gondry. I mean, Kaufman doesn't come by whimsy too easily. Gondry is Mr. Whimsy. So it's like, so if you, when you take Kaufman away, you know, the films that Gondry made after Eternal Sunshine, kind of fly off into the ether a little bit too. There's something about Kaufman that sort of anchors Gondry to an extent, and then there's a part of Gondry that makes Kaufman's script sort of take flight. And so it's a really nice alchemy between these two for this movie, and for this movie alone, because I felt like Gondry didn't really assert himself terribly much in Human Nature, which just is kind of an odd mixed bag of a film. But like, this is a strong film that kind of allows Gondry to work a little bit of magic with the camera, to be able to really think about like what Joel's headspace might look like, and to be able to kind of do pretty old-fashioned techniques, you know, of shrinking him and down to the child size at one point. I mean, it's not a deliberately kind of unspecial special effect, but it works really, really well for the film, and it feels like kind of the sort of thing that Gondry would do for one of his music videos.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's all forced perspective. There's a little making of thing on the Blu-ray that it shows so Gondry himself like walking behind the table and quote unquote shrinking. Yeah, I mean, Gondry, I like the films he made after this, but not nearly as much. Like The Science of Sleep is just pure whimsy, and it gets old, but it's kind of a delightful while it lasts. And Be Kind Rewind, I like that movie. I think there's fun stuff in that.
Yeah.
Green Hornet, I really did not see a lot of Gondry in that movie at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, Blind Taste Test, I wouldn't know those, but Gondry film. And I kind of lose track of him after that. Have you seen any of the films he put out this in the last decade or so?
I don't think that I have. I don't know if any of them really had a very strong rep, or obviously I would have.
Yeah.
Or a very wide release.
No, they didn't. But, I don't think there's been a better music video director. I mean, Spike Jonze would be kind of his competition on that front, but there's a real magic to, you know, stuff he did for Bjork. All those videos were incredible, and I think that Kylie Minogue video, Come Into My World, is like one of my favorite videos ever. And that's just all just a camera trick where she's just kind of going around in a circle, and there all these things start to repeat. It's just like, how do you do that? Like, how do you orchestrate something that fluid and beautiful? And it's nice to see that kind of attention brought to this film, and it just gives it a lightness. I mean, I think that's what you are missing from those Kaufman directed films is the impulse to see the comedy. And I mean, he's good with comedy, but to see a different
there's great gags in them, but
yeah, no, like Anomalisa is very funny, but it's like, but there is a heaviness to them, a fundamental heaviness to them, mm-hmm. that Gondry and Jones, you know, by their nature, won't allow. Like, you can't, neither one of those directors is really capable of making a movie that's completely heavy. They've got to have something a little bit, a gentleness of touch here. I think that is a big part of what makes Eternal Sunshine work.
I mean, in part, Anomalisa is just a film about depression, the unvariedness and weight and misery of depression. And I'm thinking of Ending Things as kind of fundamentally about self-hatred and suicide. And you compare that with, you know, something like this, or with Gondry's other films in general, and you just, like, Gondry's films are so sentimental. There's not just that sense of whimsy, there's that sense of, you look at something like Be Kind Rewind, and it's just like, it's the lightest piece of fluff imaginable, but it has a real faith in human nature that I just don't think is part of Charlie Kaufman's toolkit. And the idea of having the self-hating, overthinking, depressive man and the airy dream whimsy man coming together for this film is just, it's kind of astounding to me, honestly, that they work together, that their work meshes together.
I remember this is all extra textual. I remember interviewing the two of them for this movie when they came to Chicago. And I mean, it is just, their dynamic together was so strange, as you might expect. I mean, because Kaufman is what, like, one of his characters, you know, come to life, and Gondry is every bit is kind of odd and jokey and you know, and kind of silly, as you might expect. And it's just it works, though. The two of them really seem to love working together and to love what they brought out from each other.
I think it's interesting that you get that on the commentary track. I kept reading Kaufman as just kind of disapproving of almost everything Gondry said and or did. Mm-hmm. The commentary track literally starts with the shot where Jim Carrey is getting out of bed and Gondry says, oh, here's Jim getting out of bed. And Kaufman laughs at him. And he's like, is that what we're going to do for the whole commentary? Like, are we just going to describe it? And Gondry's like, well, let's just do a version of the commentary for the blind. Let's just describe everything happening on screen. And just that immediate dynamic of disapproval and joking about it back and forth. It's like, it made me a little uncomfortable. I felt like this was not a place where I would have wanted to be in the room. I kind of wish that commentary was more insightful. Mm. They get into a few things that are fun to know, like what you were talking about in terms of really, really old school filmmaking. There's a great sequence where Jim Carrey is like watching himself interact with Tom Wilkinson, talking about Clementine and what Clementine did into a tape recorder. And the camera kind of pans back and forth between observing Joel and speaking Joel from different time periods. And Gondry talks about how, like, just every time the camera moved, Carrey would run around behind the camera, change clothes, and like sit or stand in the other place. And it goes back and forth a few times that way. And just knowing that that's what is going on, that there are no editing tricks. There's no CGI. There's nothing involved except Carrey flinging himself backward and throwing on a hat and jacket almost makes the movie more magical to me.
It's funny just what seeing it now today of how the effects in it are the types of effects you would see now so heavily CGI'd, and the fact that it so is not so, you know, it makes it all the more kind of charming to watch now. But you know, you mentioned Jim Carrey. I mean, this is an unusual role for him. Maybe not the person you would expect to be cast as Joel. And of course, Kate Winslet is in this film. Maybe somebody you would expect to be cast as someone like Clementine. But I wanted to get your thoughts on the lead characters and the performers.
Oh, those are very, very different questions.
Well, let's start with Jim Carrey.
Well, as a performer, I mean, I really don't care for him. Yeah. I think he has that clown desperate to be liked thing going on that always makes me very uncomfortable. And he overacts. He overperforms and everything. And I think in this may be, I want to say it's his most tolerable performance. I think that he weaponizes that discomfort, the discomfort that makes him be a big, loud class clown. He weaponizes it and internalizes it here. You can still feel his discomfort. He just expresses it very differently. And it's really startling in this film whenever he kind of reverts to type, whenever he like gets big and loud and yelly or flaily. The moment where he smears like barbecue sauce across his throat and like throws himself on the ground and pretends that he's been murdered or something like that just particularly stands out for me, both because it's a moment of going back to Jim Carrey over the top mugging. And then just as a character beat, like she is angry, she's agitated, she's getting ready to go out. And he's trying to get her attention. He's just being like needy and weird. And she completely blanks him. She completely ignores it. And she leaves anyway. And he gets up and sits on the couch and starts cleaning off the sauce. And his facial expression in that moment is just so blank and distraught. It's like he's not acting up this big performance of sadness or disappointment or frustration. You really see this like naked moment of, I don't even exist to her right now. And it may be the greatest thing that I've ever seen him do. It's such a startling moment because he's not doing anything.
Yeah, I'm too old to have nostalgia for Jim Carrey's like, you know, golden years. I saw all those movies. I didn't really love them. But I've come around a little bit. I do appreciate more what he's doing, especially in something like Dumb and Dumber. I kind of get where the bigness is appropriate there. And I liked his performance in Man on the Moon. I think that's a good movie. But this is, you know, to me, it's in a class by itself. I mean, it's a much different performance. But I also think you don't necessarily see it the same way if you haven't either seen the Jim Carrey that preceded it, or at least kind of sense it or pick up on what's going on in those big moments that you cite, those flashes of the class clown, Jim Carrey. I mean, I think it's not necessarily an instinctive bit of casting. And I think it's ultimately a great piece of casting. I think he's fantastic in this movie.
I think there is just a little bit of, you know, man bites dog attention that tends to happen, you know, when the handful of very serious internal dialed down performances that Robin Williams did, or the handful, the couple that Adam Sandler has done. You know, there is a certain amount of, oh my gosh, like we can see how much they're acting because they're not acting. They're not overacting. And I think those roles maybe get a little overpraised, but they're still fascinating and they're still good. And here it's the same kind of thing. Like, I don't think we would process this differently if we'd never seen Jim Carrey in any other movie. But, you know, we have. It's one of those inescapable extra textuals.
Yeah, I've been trying to come to terms with this performance from the beginning because I was not a Jim Carrey fan at all. In fact, the worst afternoon I ever spent at the movies was seeing a double feature of Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, and My Father, the Hero, I think.
Was the one with
Gerard Depardieu trying to...
Yeah.
Really bad. Really, really rough double feature there. And I just never really liked his whole manic shtick. I still don't. And it does nothing for me. And even a role that he got praised wildly for when he played Andy Kaufman, I thought was too much. And so seeing him here was kind of a shock because a lot of that gets dialed down. But one of the things that's kind of effective about the performance is that I think an audience used to this actor being stretchy and being from the mask and being like a kind of plastic allows us to kind of accept the world that we're thrown into a little bit more, because we almost expect him to be in that kind of environment, and you see some of that more classic, I'm putting in air quotes there, Jim Carrey comedy, you know, in the scene where he's, you know, a kid again, where he's, you know, when he's shrunk down to kid size, you know, and so he's a natural for scenes like that. And then he does, you know, as Tasha said, do such an understated job in other places in the movie. And the scene that she cites is just such a beautiful piece of acting for, again, all the reasons she mentioned, because it does, you know, showcase his extraordinary physical chops. Not every performer could even pull off the choreography to make that fake throat slashing work, but then to also register the emotions of that moment, it works really, really well. But Kate Winslet is also in this movie. She is someone most of us would say is one of the really great actors of her generation. But you know, I'm curious to see what you all thought of her as Clementine.
I remember thinking it was a revelation that she could play that kind of role when this film first came out. Not that I really doubted she had chops to do whatever, because she was always great before that. But this was a real point of departure from her. I mean, not just, I'm not even sure she'd played an American before this, but just sort of this very recognizable type of person you probably met in your life and either delighted by or horrified by or some combination of the two, that's sort of this big person who's living through their, who's putting their personality out there and holding nothing back. You know, it's not really what we knew her from before, and she's great in it. And your sense of it hasn't really done anything to dim that for me, having just seen her in, Mayor of Easttown. You know, there's a lot of versatility. I'm here to tell you the shocking news that Kate Winslet is a very versatile and accomplished actress, and she's very good in this film.
Yeah, agreed. I really dislike this character a lot. I dislike both of these characters, and we can get into that separately, since you asked that as a separate question. But I think it's definitely a mark of her talent that she's able to play this role without going to kind of Jim Carrey heights. Like, this could be a very like flaily, shrill, over-the-top role. But I think one of the reasons I dislike Clementine so much is that I can so tangibly feel all of the anxieties that drive her, the neediness and the fear of being disliked and the fear of not being seen and the desire to have people focus on her and pay attention to her and fall over her are all things that I've encountered with real people in my life. And they're never pleasant people, and it never ends well. But you can really feel the depths to this character. You can feel the sadness at her core, like even when she's like bouncing around and being loud and silly. Like, she's kind of a classic manic pixie dream girl who flies in out of nowhere and takes a deep interest in lightening up the life of a sad and lonely man for no clear reason whatsoever. But at the same time, you kind of do see the reasoning. You kind of do see who she is just around the corners, around the edges, and in the background. And I think she does a pretty fascinating job with that.
Yeah, I don't preempt your whole "I don't like these characters" discussion, but you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to spend a lot of time with either of these people, but I do want them to be happy. Like I'm rooting for them to figure out, you know, work through what they need to work through, to if not reunite and get back together as a couple, to at least like have a be able to navigate the world better than they can at when we find at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think that is very common with Charlie Kaufman's, you know, anxiety driven, depression hounded, you know, tortured characters. Very few of the kind of Kaufman characters in Kaufman films are people you just actively don't think deserve happiness. I would maybe single out Being John Malkovich as, you know, having one of those, and he comes to a bad ending in the end. But an awful lot of these people, you kind of want to take them in and comfort them and tell them, you know, it could be okay. I think that he's very aware that these two are not good for each other, that they exacerbate each other's issues, that Joel's like reflexive judgmentalism and hostility is not good for Clementine, that Clementine's impulsiveness and constant need for change and for noise and for adventure is not good for Joel. I think he recognizes all the ways they're bad for each other. And I honestly feel like the ending is much more sour and cynical than it is like hopeful. I don't think that many people necessarily process it that way.
I'm excited to get into that thing. let me quickly on Clementine. I do think Winslet brings quite a bit of depth to the character, maybe depth that isn't even there on the page, because there's a part of Clementine that reminded me so much of Catherine Keener in Being John Malkovich, to where the character feels like a reflection of Kaufman's terror of women, right? Of them being able to embarrass him or intimidate him or humiliate him. And you see that in that first encounter where she's very aggressive with him and playful in a way that makes him kind of more uncomfortable than intrigued. But I think there's, you know, as the film progresses and as we get deeper into this performance of Winslet's, the whole character becomes a lot more well-rounded, which is hard because this is not Clementine's story. Ultimately, this is, you know, we're following Joel through this movie, and so she could be a one-dimensional character, and she isn't. So you know, the kudos to Kaufman and company and Winslet for that. You know, there's more characters, of course, than Joel and Clementine, and there's this tremendous amount of drama happening within the Lacuna team, you know, from Elijah Wood's character, you know, taking up with Clementine, to this really surprising love triangle between Kirsten Dunst's character, who's sort of the receptionist, I suppose, at Lacuna, and Mark Ruffalo, who's one of the technicians, and Tom Wilkinson, who kind of runs the place. How did all that play for you, and how does it figure into the film?
I mean, rewatching it at this point with just given how much everybody's career has expanded, it's just kind of a fascinating thing. Mm-hmm. You know, watching Mark Ruffalo like jumping around in his underwear, being goofy after kind of where his career has gone is just kind of fascinating. But also, I kind of dislike all of their characters too, saving Kirsten Dunst's. I mean, you know, Mark Ruffalo is extremely bad at his job. They're all, you know, thieves who take advantage of people. Elijah Wood's character is just like a favor-sharking, stalking creepmo. I love the performances. I love the writing on all of them so much. The whole, like, complicated deal with Elijah Wood's character sneaking information out of the business and then writing a story in his mind about how he and Clementine are like now engaged in some kind of torrid affair, which as we see them together over and over, it's clear that's not true at all as far as she's concerned. I think all of that is fascinating and insightful and done with like a horrible kind of humor. But the relationship between Tom Wilkinson and Kirsten Dunst's character is, for me, one of the emotional hearts of the film. Just understanding where she's coming from and what she wants and how she resolved that, and then it was taken away from her. She helped it happen, and then what she does as a result, I think is just, it's all a micro story pressed off to the side, but I think it's all really fascinating.
I'd forgotten how good and creepy Elijah Wood was in this movie, which if you look at him, this is his first thing he does after Lord of the Rings. After this, he does Sin City. So there really is like a big run to not Frodo. You know, you want charming, sweet Frodo. I'm going to give you exactly the opposite of that. I do like the way I do like the way they use his size and his like innate boyishness as to make him just kind of like the shrimp and the outcast and their little gang of mind wipers or whatever. And you do buy him as someone who would step beyond the bounds of privacy and respect that are presumably written to the contract of Lacuna.
You know what it reminded me of, Elijah Wood's, that whole subplot was the stretch in Groundhog Day where Bill Murray's character is trying to orchestrate the same date and trying to get it right, and it gets worse and worse and worse because his version of that date is becoming less and less sincere. And so here, you know, Elijah Wood is copying all of Joel's moves and lines and everything, but Clementine can. Well, there's a sense of deja vu, I think, there, of course, but I think she could just feel like it's not working. There's something just intangibly off about it, or tangibly, intangibly off. I think that's a really clever part of the movie. And then, of course, the love triangle, again, it adds just a whole nother layer to the film that, you know, you can miss. You know, I certainly wasn't focused on that the first time I saw it. I mean, the first time I think it was more swimming through it and just trying to piece together how it worked and where the timeline was. And, you know, and then even the second viewing, again, was just really focused on that central relationship and kind of getting all the pieces right. But just this little part of it is, really enriches the film.
And Dunst is so good too. I mean, she's been so good in everything she's done lately. But I think I'd forgotten how already like fully there she was as an actor at this point. And that just is a heartbreaking performance.
Yeah, you really feel for her. I mean, to some degree, you feel for Elijah Wood too. I think that's an interesting distinction.
Nah.
I feel for him in his desperation to make something happen that's never going to happen. But I think it's really interesting the difference between kind of disliking Joel and Clementine, but wanting them both to be happy, wanting them both to get what they want, and maybe understand that what they want shouldn't be each other, that there are other healthier relationships for both of them, more nurturing relationships that'll give them what they need, versus kind of liking, kind of not liking Elijah Wood's character, but definitely not thinking that he should get what he wants. There's no world where it would be good if his plans followed through.
Well, it's a horrible violation.
Yeah, he's completely unethical. I think that the difference between the way Jim Carrey delivers the line about being completely happy for the first time in his life and the way Elijah Wood delivers it when he's trying to make something happen that isn't happening, when he's trying to mimic Joel. It's just a great, piece of discrepancy in performance. They're both good line deliveries, but like put next to each other, it's just the contrast is so good. It tells you so much about what's going on with both of them.
It's really funny. Elijah Wood's character is a bit of a creep here, but the way I kind of think of it is like he's kind of a minor leaguer who needs to steal signs in order to play in the majors. You know what I mean? It's kind of like that kind of thing. I mean, and then to get back to the love triangle, like Kirsten Dunst makes this decision to release, all of this information to kind of upend the business. What did you think of that decision?
I love it. I think that she realizes what the theme of the movie is, I think, effectively, is if you don't understand your mistakes, if you don't fess up to your mistakes, if you don't internalize and think about them, you're going to repeat them. And I think that this movie is fundamentally saying that, people who don't take responsibility for the ways that they treat themselves and each other are just not ever going to be happy, and maybe they're never going to know why. I think that this is fundamentally a movie about how you have to learn from your own mistakes and you have to accept them. And I think that where Joel and Clementine kind of end is they both tried to dodge that in their own way. and ended up where they are. And they're just about to repeat their same mistakes. And the only sense of salvation in that is that they've both listened to these tapes. They both have a little more sense of what they're getting into. So history isn't just absolutely destined to repeat itself. I think that when Kirsten Dunst's character sends all of those letters and tapes to everybody and explains what happened, you know, she's doing it selflessly. I think she's come to understand, like looking at her own life, that it doesn't help, you know, to cut memories out of your life. It actually makes things worse. And she's thinking about all of the people who are just guaranteed to continue making the same mistakes over and over. She's just trying to help.
I guess one thing I would add to it, and this speaks to the ending of the film, the philosophy of the film, is that I think that it's not just mistakes, but experience, that we have to experience every part of life, even the bad stuff, you know, and it's not necessarily you will learn from the bad stuff. You will learn from the painful mistakes, which you will. I mean, if you have a relationship that doesn't work out or, you know, if, you know, and you kind of have to wrestle with decisions that you made or actions that you made that you regret. I mean, that's great. I mean, that's part of growing up, but just generally we should not want for ourselves only happy experiences, that there's something about other, that there are other emotions that can and should bring color to our lives and range to our emotional understanding of the world here, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you, and Inside Out agrees with you. I wonder, I don't feel like Joel, though, is there. I don't think that he's understanding what the bad times meant to him and savoring them and wanting to learn from them when he tries to hang onto those memories. Mm-hmm. I think he's realizing that he's throwing out the good with the bad, you know, that in a kind of a fit of spitefulness and hurt, he made the decision to throw out even the parts of the relationship that he loved. Mm. And he wants to hang on to them for, I think, more sentimental reasons than to learn from them or to change his life or, you know, to help him with Clementine in the future. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe there isn't as much cynicism as I feel in the idea of the two of them, like looking at where the relationship ended up and knowing the choices they made and still consciously trying to start again. Mm-hmm. I just, because of the way those two characters are drawn, because of their huge and various dysfunctions and how incredibly cruel they are to each other in the relationship, I feel like they're still doomed. And I don't feel like there's a happy ending in them trying again. I feel like they're both needy, needy people. Mm-hmm. And they feel sort of a compulsion to, I don't think it's going to work out for them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not, but I think the alternative where they come to that, if they came to that conclusion, if they said, oh gosh, we listened to these tapes and yeah, it doesn't really look like we're going to get along that well. That's the worst ending to me. I do like the, I think, you know, and there's something, you know, if you're talking about we need these experiences to happen to so we can learn from them. Maybe that's what the movie hopes they're going to be able to do. You know, that if they can hear them the way they talk about each other and they can, you know, I mean, how often do you get, you know, such an unvarnished reflection of what another person feels about you? And if you can kind of like internalize that in the right way, maybe you can correct those mistakes and take responsibility for behaving poorly in a relationship and maybe doing better this time. I don't know. I like it. I like the ending the way it is.
I think it's a question mark and you can't draw any conclusions from it. I think that's the appropriate ending for this film.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I certainly don't think, I think you're right. And if they just were like, oh my gosh, like listen to all this stuff. We were terrible. Goodbye forever. You're right. That would be a terrible ending. I'm definitely not saying it's the wrong ending. I'm just saying it's a very sad ending. I don't see any romanticism, and I don't see a lot of hope in this ending. I see a very intellectualized Charlie Kaufman-esque ending that says, we just keep getting stuck in our own heads and we don't like it there, but maybe there's no escape. I'm not inherently against that message. I like a good downer film ending. I like cynicism on screen because it's rare and it's daring and it's textured and it's interesting. And sometimes it's realistic. I feel like this ending may be a realistic ending in spite of all of the fantasy elements. And I absolutely respect it. it just doesn't make me happy. It doesn't make me feel that Gondry sense of sentimental whimsy that like a Be Kind Rewind does. And that's fine. I'll take this movie over Be Kind Rewind any day of the week.
Yes, most definitely. Well, we're going to have lots more to talk about it with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, particularly the theme of memory, which comes up in a big way in Reminiscence next week.
You're right. I hadn't picked up on that.
Really, that's a hidden thing. You didn't pick up on it in our little sneeches.
You picked up on it when we talked about it last week, Keith, but we decided to erase your memory.
Oh, whoa.
We didn't think it was doing you any good.
This is huge. Okay, well.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that we'll be right back with feedback. Now it's time for feedback, where we answer any questions and respond to any comments about our episodes or anything else in the world of film. First up is a voicemail from a very familiar listener named Bob, whose viewing of Annette suggested another movie that paired well with it.
Hey, Next Picture Show, this is Bob. While listening to your great discussion of Annette, I thought of a connection I hadn't noticed before to another rock opera with an eponymous hero, that being Tommy. Tommy, like Annette, is the son of a parent culpable in the death of his other parent. And while Annette has the voice of her dead mother, Tommy grows to have the face of his dead father, which in both cases is a tormenting reminder to the surviving parent. Tommy, like Annette, becomes a big sensation, culminating in a big out-of-control show that demonstrates both the power and limitations of punishment, forgiveness, and catharsis. Also, both works have a lot of brilliant moments, but can get a little wearying and off-putting as they go along when seen as a film. There are enormous differences, of course, especially the quest to cure Tommy, and how it shows that Anne Margaret, and even the ape-like Oliver Reed, for all their flaws, are much better parents than Adam Driver's character. But I still find the parallels so clear in retrospect that I'm amazed I didn't see them earlier, which is probably a tribute to how dynamically Sparks launches Annette in the beginning. Which, by the way, reminds me that Sparks is the name of a song and recurring theme in Tommy. Love the podcast. Bye.
Well, that's a very good voicemail from Bob, I think. And I know that Tommy was something we surely discussed that one, right? I think as a potential pairing with Annette, or did we not?
I can't remember. I've actually never seen the film version of Tommy. I've listened to the album plenty of times, but I've never seen the film version.
Wow, we never find a situation where I've seen a movie that you guys haven't. That's bizarre.
Looks like we're there.
I guess so. It's been long enough that certainly these parallels would not have specifically stood out to me. But I think this Bob guy, I like the way this snrub thinks. He sounds pretty smart and on the ball. Like maybe he knows a lot about film. He also sounds attractive and like he's a good kisser.
Very intuitive with this yeah. voicemail.
We don't usually get that kind of response from Tasha from feedback, but here it is. Yeah, I had heard Tommy did seem like, you know, when you ran down that list of kind of unconventional musicals that would pair well with Annette, that was one that would have been on that list. And I think maybe had I seen it, maybe because I think I was the first one to see Annette, even though I didn't participate in the podcast. Had I seen Tommy, maybe I would have said you should do that instead of you should do One from the Heart. But it sounds like you had a good time with One from the Heart, so I'm glad you did that. The other funny thing too about is that we also missed an opportunity this week to pick another Ken Russell movie that would have gone with Reminiscence, which is Altered States.
Oh, sure.
That would have paired just fine with Reminiscence as well. So Ken Russell is just getting ignored left and right on this podcast.
We got to make it a point to do a Russell film at some point then, right?
Do we?
The Devils.
Sure.
There's going to be something that's going to pair with The Devils, and maybe we'll do that.
Just before we move off Tommy and Annette, even having seen Tommy, I'm not sure that I would have picked up on that parallel because the focus on Tommy feels like it's so much on Tommy as opposed to being on Anne Margaret. The focus just seems so different in terms of whose story it fundamentally is. Because even though Annette's name is the title, even though so much of the action centers around her, she moves the plot forward, she brings it to a conclusion. And the end is just kind of about her and how she takes things and how she's changed. Like, even so, it feels more like it's Adam Driver's story. It feels like he's the one that goes through the biggest arc. So I think it's a really interesting observation, but I think even if I were more familiar with Tommy, the movie, than I was, I'm not sure that I would have drawn that that connection.
Okay. Well, thanks very much to Bob for that voicemail. We have one other piece of feedback this week about The Green Knight. Listener Spencer weighs in on the ending, which he understands in a different way than we did. Those of you who haven't seen The Green Knight should probably stop the podcast now and wait for our next episode, unless you just want to hear the kind of end of the podcast jibber jabber, because this is talking about the very end of the film. Spoilers ahead. Tosh, you want to read this one?
Sure. Spencer writes, "While I loved your perspectives on The Green Knight, I was surprised to hear the near universal interpretation of its ending. My immediate reaction was that The Green Knight did indeed chop off Gawain's head in a completion of the game. The game being the continued pursuit of man justifying conquest in the name of honor and righteousness. I think of the never-ending list of American wars fought over and over, which have no ends better than their beginnings. On and on it goes. It's an existentially pointless game, and that's a message I took from the film. Now, off with our heads."
Yeah, so did we get this ending wrong, or maybe the ending is more of a question mark? Like, what do you think of Spencer's perspective on this one?
Well, David Lowery actually talked to, I believe it was Joanna Robinson at Vanity Fair. She asked him about it, and he kind of just came out and said, "Oh yeah, no, he definitely chops off his head." They wrote it that way, they filmed it that way, and then decided it just didn't work for the film. That wasn't where they wanted to end it, so they decided to leave it more open ended. And it's a rare case where I'm feeling a little Scott Tobias here about the extra textuals. I'm not sure that I wanted to know that about the decision Lowery made to not put in something that he'd written and shot, because it feels to me like the text is the text. You know, it feels to me like that's an interesting thing to hear, but I'm not sure that ultimately it feels like it's the story that the film feels like it's telling. Which I guess is just sort of a little Ouroboros of intent there, because the reason the story feels that like that's not the story it's telling is because it isn't, because he cut the ending off. But I think it is interesting to come in and look at it again with Lowery having expressed that intention that he never intended to follow the poem where, you know, the Green Knight just cuts Gawain a little and lets him go for honorably showing up. Like he always intended for him to die, having achieved his honor by not running away from his death.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you don't want it to be an ambiguous ending, you don't cut the part that makes it unambiguous. So I'm happy living with the ambiguity there. Yeah. I'm usually happy living with the ambiguity at the end of movies. Hence my reaction to Eternal Sunshine, and you know, a lot of other things, I'm sure.
Well, I would say, is Spencer correct in saying that this game is about the pursuit of man justifying conquest in the name of honor and righteousness? I didn't feel like conquest was really the goal here. The honor part was important in being chivalrous and, you know, becoming a better, more worthy person, I guess. But that seems like a good goal that shouldn't necessarily end with one's head getting chopped off.
Yeah, but I think, to go with his reading, I think the honor is tied in with also, you know, taming the land. You get all these images of the forest being cleared, the whole thing with the old gods fleeing, or whatever, however you want to interpret that scene with the giants. I think that's definitely, you can read that into this film pretty easily.
We had a piece at Polygon. The headline was, "The Green Knight doesn't have to discuss race to make its racial message clear." And the writer that put together this piece, Angeline Rodriguez, who's a book editor, came to me with it to talk primarily about how Gawain's skin color, how having an Indian man at the round table kind of messes with the dynamics. And she actually gets into some of what Spencer is talking about here in terms of the perceived imperialism of the round table. You know, the round table is about all of the lands it's conquered. Think about the scene in Excalibur where all of the knights meet up on the hillside and Arthur asks them, you know, how did it go? And they each like roar with glee about the campaigns they've just finished and the peoples that they've just brought to their knees and the lords that they've killed or forced to surrender. Like that is sort of the story of King Arthur and the round table. And you can look at it as a story of bringing a Savage Land together, or, you know, stamping out a bunch of individual rulers and claiming everything for yourself. Mm. The sequence in Green Knight where Gawain emerges from the forest to a battlefield where, you know, hundreds of corpses are just lying in the open, and he meets a thief who says, you know, the rumor is that the king slew all these men himself with his own hands. It's like a lot of people have interpreted that in interesting ways, both going back to Arthurian myths, which is where that idea came from, but also just talking about how, you know, King Arthur is inherently a warlike man who, you know, waged conquest on the country and then cut down all the trees and tamed nature and brought everything under his control. And in the end, he's old and decrepit and surrounded by old and decrepit knights. But when Gawain wants to impress him, his first act is to cut off the head of an unarmed man who's standing helpless in front of him, you know, not to give him a little cut or a little love tap, which, as he says, will be returned in a year's time, but to try to murder him. And there's a lot that you can read into that about, you know, unequal war and about imperialism and shutting down the enemy preemptively, like because you think that they might act against you. There's certainly been a lot written about it, about the imperialism ideas in this movie.
All right. Well, I guess this once again proves that the Green Knight is the, you know, best film to talk about of 2021. Is this endlessly fascinating. So thank you, Spencer, for your perspective. We always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at Reminiscence, a science fiction thriller in which memories are explored and investigated rather than erased. Look for that episode next Tuesday, or you can subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. If you want to hear it without ads, and while surrounded by extra Next Picture Show written and recorded content, come support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. Find us at nextpictureshow.net. And follow us on Twitter at Next Picture Pod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, remember that Valentine's Day is a holiday invented by greeting card companies to make people feel like crap.